Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marcus Hippy.
On today's show, we'll be heading into the future with Lydia Yee, curator at London's Whitechapel Gallery. She'll be discussing its latest showcase, Is This Tomorrow?
We'll also be speaking to artist Andy Holden. He'll be talking through his animation work, Laws of Motion in a Cartoon Landscape, that combines life's big questions with outlandish characters.
And we'll be speaking to Ece Temelkuran, the journalist and author's book How to Lose a Country details the dangers of complacency in an ever more divisive political era.
That's all ahead. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll spin some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, it's been, I have to say, this week in London, there's been hints of springtime. I know it's probably illusory, but it's been sunny. It's been positively balmy in terms of the temperatures. And one thing that we like to do every week is sort of set our watches, if you like, to the goings-on around the world in the next 7 days. Who is there, Marcus, who could join us, who could, I don't know, shed a little light on the future?
The man who is helping us with all that is our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something. And happy Sunday, Fernando. How are you doing today?
Happy Sunday. I'm feeling quite fresh as well, Marcus, I have to say. After this lovely sunny week, I agree with you, Tom.
Fernando, you look like spring has sprung. You're wearing two different shades of yellow. One slightly more sort of pastel, one very much the yellow of the Seleção.
Because that's the tip, you know, you should always mix your yellows. Don't wear the same tone for everything.
Oh, very
so mix the kind of the egg yolk one of the more pastel-like.
What kind of other tips can you share with us today?
Well, I have some good stories. I mean, let's start. It's the, you know, February and March is the award season, and I love a good award. So on the 20th of February, which is on Wednesday, it's time for the Brit Awards. And I personally find it very important because the UK punches above its weight when it comes to music. I mean, from Pet Shop Boys to Bucks Fizz, I mean, got the joke on me.
Very contemporary.
Very contemporary. But it's interesting. I mean, the Grammys has just gone and Dua Lipa, a British singer, did very well there. So it'd be quite interesting to see, I mean, who could win. There's some very interesting nominations. Again, a very strong year for women in music. Both the Brits and the Grammys have been criticized for the lack of kind of female nominees. This changed quite a lot. So, for example, this year, besides Dua Lipa, you have Georgia Smith, Anne-Marie. Lot of kind of young British female singers. I think that's a trend. And even for best group, which traditionally have been all male, but this year we have a few more females there.
I'm wondering, Fernando, when you get a bit older, sometimes your music taste gets stuck in a certain era. Are you still excited by the latest music, the latest releases from the UK, or are you listening to what was going on in the early noughties?
I force myself to enjoy more what young people are listening, what young artists. You have to process because, yes, my mind is a bit stuck in the Eurodance of the 90s, but I do try my best to keep up.
Can I just say, Fernando mentioned Bucks Fizz and Pet Shop Boys. Early noughties, early 80s.
I mean, the Pet Shop Boys just released a new EP, Agenda EP. We now talk about Brexit. I mean, they're still quite relevant in some ways.
I just wonder though, Fernando, our brothers and sisters on the other side of the Atlantic, they're not going to be looking at the Brit Awards, are they? Or is there actually a bit of pickup?
I think they will. I mean, the Brit Awards, they are more fun than the Grammys because more things can go wrong in a way.
Yes.
Remember
Madonna who fell over? That was Brits as well.
Exactly. And do you know who's opening the Brit Awards? It's Hugh Jackman singing The Greatest Showman. Okay, we can make fun because, you know, I'm personally not a big fan, but this album has been number one in the albums chart for 28 weeks in the UK. I mean, this is impressive.
That is staggering. Let's move on. What else have you got for us?
On Saturday, the 23rd of February, it's time for the Razzies, or the 39th Golden Raspberry Awards. I mean, they award the worst films of the year.
Which films do you think should be included on that list?
Well, I don't know which ones should be included, but I know the nominees for Best Picture. For Worst Picture.
It's like Best Worst Picture.
Exactly. You have Gotti with John Travolta, you know, which was a complete disaster. The Halftime Murders, which is kind of a mixture of puppets with Human Beings. I haven't seen that one, but I know Melissa McCarthy is in it.
I mean, that also does sound appalling.
And then you have Holmes and Watson. Robin Hood, nobody needed another remake of Robin Hood. It was a well-deserved flop. I'm sorry if somebody is involved in the production of the film, but, you know, it's not needed. And Winchester, poor Helen Mirren, she tried to do horror, didn't work.
Also, wow. I just wonder, Faye, is the Razzies, because they, when they started out, they were kind of a marginal thing. It was a bit funny. These days, we've even had the recipients, the stars, turning up to actually, didn't Sandra Bullock, I think, won a couple and actually went along to...
And Halle Berry as well.
To claim the gong. Is it this kind of crazy thing where all publicity is good publicity and actually... People, as long as you're an extreme on the spectrum, whether it's good or bad, people kind of don't mind being lauded in that way.
I think actors know sometimes when they do a bad film as well, in a way. So they kind of make fun of themselves. But there's a thing, a new award, which I thought it was quite interesting, which is the Redeeming Award. So they kind of nominate people that have been quite bad in the past, but then they kind of... Melissa McCarthy, indeed. You know, she's nominated for Best Actress this year. Peter Farrelly as well, the director of Green Book. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's more well-known for his kind of... stupid comedies. So, I mean, it's... But I don't always agree with the Razzies. In 95, they awarded for worst film the classic, iconic Showgirls. Didn't deserve.
But, Fernando, this is iconic in as much as it is supposed to be the exemplar of the so bad it's good. Objectively, an appalling film.
But it's bad. It's better so bad it's good than it's just so bad that it's just
What's your all-time favorite bad, good, good, bad film?
Should I say Showgirls or even Madonna's version of Swept Away?
Thank you very much. That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco joining us here on the Monocle Weekly.
We'll be speaking to Lydia Yee from the Whitechapel Gallery in a moment. London's Whitechapel Gallery is looking into the future with a new exhibition, Is This Tomorrow? It invites some of the world's leading artists, designers and architects to imagine what might be around the corner in years to come.
The showcase also references an earlier exhibition staged over 60 years ago at the same location. And here to tell us more is Lydia Yee, Chief Curator at Whitechapel Gallery. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Lydia. So could you tell us about, before we talk about this new exhibition, could you tell us about the old exhibition that took place 60 years ago and the relationship between the new one and the old one?
In the autumn of 1956, Whitechapel Gallery presented an exhibition called This Is Tomorrow. It came about in a quite spontaneous manner. A group of artists and architects who had been gathering on a fairly regular basis were approached about the idea of mounting an exhibition that had to do with collaboration between painters, sculptors on the one hand, and architects on the other. These people included members of the independent group, such as Alison and Peter Smithson, Eduardo Paolozzi, Richard Hamilton, for example, but also people affiliated with the British constructivist circles, like Kenneth and Mary Martin, and other figures like Ernle Goldfinger. But originally, the exhibition was supposed to take place elsewhere. The groups didn't quite see eye to eye, and it took a while to sort out some of the issues. Subsequently, Theo Crosby approached Whitechapel's director, Brian Robertson, about hosting the exhibition there. And then it took place in the autumn of 56, ran for about a month, and presented 12 projects by collaborations between small groups of artists and architects. And it was all put together in a very crowded installation on the ground floor space of the gallery.
And it was really something of a landmark. And I just wondered, did that represent almost something of a spectre, or was it very positive in terms of when you then approached this next generation? You reel off some of the names, Goldfinger, Hamilton, Eduardo Paolozzi, a real amazing people, storied careers. I don't know if it's always the case, but do artists find that's just a great inspiration? It's a great heritage to follow. Or is there a bit of nervousness that, wow, you know, can we live up to what was done all those years ago?
I think it has been inspirational. This Is Tomorrow has been one of the exhibitions that's most revisited through our archive. Many people come to Whitechapel Gallery to research about the history of that exhibition. Artists, art historians, critics, architects. It produced a lot of dialogue and debate over the years. So most people in the kind of worlds of art and architecture today have some familiarity with the exhibition. And while they might be intimidated by it, it's also a strong history against which to respond.
So tell me about how you went on creating this new exhibition then. What was your starting point?
So I took two main aspects from the original 56 exhibition, which was the point of collaboration. So it was very important that artists and architects have a meaningful collaboration. I approached various artists on the one hand and architects on the other and gave them initially an opportunity to suggest a potential collaborator, or if they didn't have someone in mind or were open to the idea of a blind date, I presented them with some people that they should meet and begin a dialogue with. The second important aspect to this project was the fact that the original exhibition, This Is Tomorrow, set out a vision for the future. Knowingly or unknowingly, I think it did that. And that was the second part of the brief, that each of the pairs or teams should have something to say about the future.
Can I ask, it's also interesting that we should remember that the exhibition that took place 60 years ago was called This Is Tomorrow, and this exhibition is called Is This Tomorrow? How is the mood different in these exhibitions?
Well, it's certainly a very different time in 2019. I think there's a great deal of uncertainty at the moment, not only about the current political circumstances here in Britain, but abroad as well, but also about bigger issues like what's happening with the environment, what's happening in the tech sector. All these things like bioengineering are having some effect on our future that we cannot quite predict. And I think this was also an impetus for the exhibition, that in this moment where we have a lot of potential pathways to the future, it was a good time to step back and reassess what some of those directions might be. But I think in 1956, maybe if the exhibition had happened a few years later, it would have also been maybe less positive in some ways and maybe more questioning in other ways. 1956 marked an important moment, I think, in Britain in terms of just coming out of the post-war period, the end of rationing, the beginning of an NHS. So I think there was a great deal of optimism about the future in 1956. One of the things I searched for in the original exhibition was to see if there was any sense of the kind of nuclear threat. I could only see among the kind of projects one image and a small collage of other material of the atomic explosion. So generally, I think that was something in the background and would only kind of come up maybe 5-10 years later.
We'll talk perhaps more in a moment about some of the artists involved and other people from other practice in this year's iteration. But to that point about artists and architects in particular, sometimes their interests, their ambitions broadly are presented in opposition, you know, that there's conflicts between what motivates an artist and an architect. Is there something interesting in that conflict, if you agree that there is any, or actually is it more interesting where they are very much on the same page? What did that sort of conflict, if there is one, does that offer anything interesting?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as a conflict. I would say maybe more of a difference in approach and also a difference in the way that both sides of the equation work and who the audiences are. Artists, on the one hand, tend to work more on their own in a studio situation in quite a small team, maybe one assistant, if any at all. Whereas architects, by nature, have to work in a much bigger collaboration and also to the requirements of clients. Artists don't usually have that constraint unless they're commissioned to make a work for, let's say, a public sculpture. So I think they each bring different aspects to a collaboration, and they do share a lot of things in common. One of the things that I found fascinating was that both the artists and architects' work was heavily research-driven. Artists often have find a way to take this research and put it into a kind of fantastical narrative, where architects might not quite have that option, but they do this research on similar topics just the same. And perhaps this was an outlet to ask artists and architects, and architects in particular, to use that research to tell a different kind of story, one that didn't necessarily have a permanent outcome.
If you look at that lineup of artists and architects in this new exhibition and contrast that to the lineup of who were participating in this exhibition in 1956, how different is it? Mm-hmm. Can you see that times have changed?
Definitely times have changed. I mean, I've tried to approach artists and architects of a similar generation. So the 56 exhibition had a lot of practitioners in their 30s and early 40s, with few in their 50s. But I think the way the fields are so much more competitive today and there's so many more opportunities in many ways that a lot of the figures are more established and have already name recognition today, whereas among the 56 participants, probably only Goldfinger had been building. Smithson's just started to have some commissions, and the artists were very much less known.
And I would have imagined that back in 56, the lineup was consisting mostly of white men.
That's true. There were, I think, three women. And I did read in some of the archive correspondence Whitechapel's director urging the curator not to include one of them. I mean, I think they wanted to replace this woman with a much more well-known figure, Barbara Hepworth. So, you know, I think the curators of the 56 exhibition took a risk in allowing younger artists to participate.
Well, and just at that point about risk-taking, I just wonder if we take a step back and look at your wider brief, chief curator, of course, at the gallery, how much of what you do is motivated by your fascination with specific topics, artists, ways of practice, and how much is there this sort of more social, even political elements to it? You know, do you find that you're, again, I asked you about conflict and whether there was anything between artists and architects, do you find yourself conflicted internally about what shapes your curatorial agenda?
I mean, I think there are debates that shape my curatorial agenda, and I try to present different sides of the equation. So an exhibition like this, Is This Tomorrow, includes both artists and architects who might be considered more formal, more concerned with materials. But there's others that are have a political message to get across. And in a group show, it's quite important to survey the breadth of that, to create a dialogue between the ends of the spectrum. And I think overall in the Whitechapel Gallery program, we try to do that across our various exhibitions in any one season, but across the year as well.
What do you think are the favorites in this new exhibition?
Favorites? I guess that would probably depend on who you'd ask. Just by looking at some of the architects or artists that some people have already pointed out, it really depends on their perspective. Some people tend to, you know, cite projects like David Adjaye and Kapwani Kawanga's Sankofa Pavilion, because they appreciate the form, the architectonics of it, the use of new materials, while others are much more gravitate towards political topics. There's a project by Spanish architect Andres Jaque, Office for Political Innovation, collaborating with Jacoby Satterwhite, a New York-based artist, and that's a much more political work that is dealing with confluence of conflicting issues, fracking and real estate development on one hand, genetic engineering on the other, and queer desire and the new sites of pornography on the third hand. So, yes, there's, you know, works probably you wouldn't expect to see together, but I think that's also the beauty and strength of a project like this.
Yeah, maybe just finally, Mark's already mentioned this sort of playful flipping of the title and this question about, you know, is this tomorrow? Does the exhibition, in a sense, I don't even know whether you were directly seeking to do this, but does it offer consolation or concern about what the future looks like? Is that what it was setting out to do in your view?
That's part of it. I think Is This Tomorrow asks what kinds of visions of the future might exist side by side. I mean, today we live in a society where there's so many different narratives going on at any one moment. And by raising a question rather than proclaiming very strongly, this is tomorrow, we're asking audiences, artists, architects, and organizers, you know, how can we cope with all these different narratives? How do we make them into a comprehensible narrative? Or can we reconcile them at all? And I think some of the projects suggest that many of these conflicts will continue to exist side by side, and future generations will have to kind of try to unpick some of these things.
And Is This Tomorrow is at London's Whitechapel Gallery until the 12th of May, and we do recommend you head down. Thank you very much for joining us here in the Monocle Weekly, Lydia.
Thank you.
Marcus, I think it's high time on the programme for some music. Are you ready for that?
I like the idea. Do you have something lined up already?
Well, I do. And given what we've just been talking about, something a little futuristic, while also looking into the past. How? Well, New Orleans jazz experimentalist Christian Scott, featuring the talents of Saul Williams on vocals, has this. It's Ancestral Recall.
That was Christian Scotton-Saul Williams with Ancestral Recall. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Artist, musician and filmmaker Andy Holden uses cartoons to try and make sense of an increasingly confusing world. His animation project, Laws of Motion in a Cartoon Landscape, is currently showing at London's Cinema Museum. It uses animation to look at ideas ranging from the work of Aristotle to the CERN Physics Lab in Switzerland to Google's enormous reach and the looming figure of, yes, it's him again, Donald Trump.
Earlier, Monocle's Augustin Macellari met Andy to learn more.
Laws of Motion in a Cartoon Landscape. Well, it started off as a talk, as you know, like a long, long time ago. And then through a period of gestation and development, it then became this two-channel animated film, which I actually made for Glasgow International 2 years ago. And it's been on the road ever since. I took it to Venice and Dubai and America twice and Canada. But this is the first time showing it in London, actually. I couldn't find anywhere to show it initially. And then the Cinema Museum, which is this very peculiar and wonderful building just close to Elephant and Castle. It's like a grotto to the golden days of cinema, and it's full of old projectors. Well, cinema is a mass spectacle, and obviously cartoons were part of that, and I thought, okay, this is the place to show it.
And is it kind of important to you that it's maybe not necessarily an art space, that it's somewhere else?
I could just imagine what it would do to the work. You know, a lot of my films have always been installed in elaborate ways, making these structures for them. You remember back to Mims, which was sort of a seven-channel film, but split across a huge structure that you navigated through, and the films are kind of set within it. And the previous show I did in London was Natural Selection with Art Angel. And again, it was opening up an old library and natural history museum and showing the films in there. So I've always been into film in its most expanded sense. But Laws of Motion is just a two-screen animation. So, but by putting it in the cinema museum, I think that does the rest of the job for me.
The crux of the film is that the logic isn't just utterly surreal. It exists within these universes. There are these rules which you establish, and maybe you could give some examples of.
Yeah, so there's this idea that anything can happen, but actually not anything can. Certain things make more sense than others, and some of that's through repetition, but some of it's through a kind of appealing to a different set of sensory logic that isn't rational logic, but it isn't necessarily just fanciful. So law one is anybody suspended in space will remain in space until made aware of its situation. And basically this is one that's become more and more interesting because it's actually starting to be deployed as a metaphor for huge amounts of things that have unfolded, which is, so it's the idea you walk off a cliff edge and you don't fall down until you look down. When you look down, then you fall down. And that's because, so it's like awareness or self-awareness is the actual factor that causes gravity to intervene. So there's this link between this sort of your own subjective position and something that seems to be some objective force. And that became a great metaphor for the 2008 banking crash. So capital as a whole was floating, free-floating, and suddenly everyone looked down and went, oh, there's actually nothing below this. And it came down, or whether that be particular governments or even particular concepts or financial ideas, they all seem to work very nicely for those. So, there was this idea that in the cartoons, well, why does that make sense? Well, it must have some grounding. And it makes sense to children intuitively. Seems to be as close to universally funny as, so there's something primal there. So law 10 is everything falls faster than an anvil, and there was other ones that started to relate to contemporary ideas of post-Newtonian physics in a way. So as speed increases, objects can be in several places at once, and so then that seemed actually a good metaphor for the way technology had changed the political space a lot, that multiple fragments of things being simultaneously in different places, but also on a level of kind of electrons started to also hold up. But in cartoons, it's played out all the time. You run up to a T-junction and you go both left and right. And there's some ethics in there as well, like why can't Wile E. Coyote catch Roadrunner? So I started thinking, oh, you can use these ways of trying to understand this, this current precarious moment.
Elsewhere, you've also kind of worked with cartoons. We were just discussing that you have a work in a current Somerset House exhibition, which is about peanuts. What is it that draws you to that? Is it something about the kind of the intersection between something which, as you say, which is universally appealing, but which also has some slightly broader allegorical reach? What is it that attracts you to cartoons as a kind of field for exploration?
I think there's a few ways of answering that. I mean, cartoons were my first visual language. I wanted to be a cartoonist, I think, and I used to draw a copy from the comics, and I used to draw. There's like a fresh source of visual stimulation. Yeah, it's how I learned to draw, really, was copying cartoons. So there was that very personal narrative. And they were then probably my bridge into pop art. You know, I liked things with clear black line, and I liked... And actually then pop art was my way into, oh, art, like art as a whole thing that I didn't know. So there was that trajectory too. But then it wasn't like that then continued. It sort of disappeared. And yeah, it definitely resurfaced when I was starting to make sculptural objects and trying to find, yeah, a way of talking about this sort of... Initially it was about gravity and weight and materiality. And cartoons had actually a really great way for all their thinness and lack of depth. They communicate a great weight somehow. So... there was that. But the relationship with Schultz was something slightly different. I mean, it was a great... I got the privilege of doing a conversation with Jean Schultz, Charles Schultz's wife, for the opening of this show, and talking about this legacy of Peanuts and why does it still appeal, or why did it appeal to me? And I was saying it was a different relationship I had to it as a child. As a child, I liked Peanuts, but I liked Snoopy, or I had a cuddly Snoopy or whatever. But it wasn't the same as when I then rediscovered it as a young, like, I guess kind of early 20s, and I was starting to dabble with philosophy. And then I kind of went back to some of my old Peanut strips. I was like, this is an incredibly economic way of talking about some incredibly complicated things. And sometimes that's the best way to talk about things that are hard to talk about. With these, you can, cartoons can contain paradox. They can contain, I don't know, multiple ideas of something. And Schultz was the master of economy and enigmatic, but essences again. Maybe it isn't, it's an essence thing. And he was incredible at that. So the Peanut show is interesting. It's sort of full of, this legacy. How do we make sense of the legacy of Charlie Brown? And a number of contemporary artists were invited to respond to it. I actually made a film about friendship. So my work is all about what it means to be friends with someone, actually. As that, and that was a theme that ran through Peanuts that I always found very moving, that was a difficult thing to talk about. And so I made a 40-minute four-screen film. Yeah, trying to reflect on the nature of friendship.
One of the things that kind of struck me, you know, just as we've been discussing, but also looking at your work, is this sort of, I guess, your personal attachment to them. You know, you talk about the exhibition that you made with your father, and it's as much about, you know, the process of birds making nests as it is a reflection on your own relationship with your father. How do you kind of... how do you relate to that? Is this a starting point for you? Because a lot of the things of yours that I've seen have had this autobiographical underpinning.
Often I want to talk about something more abstract, something larger, but I don't know how to get... I wouldn't know how to go directly towards it. So you always go at it indirectly or through something that I know I can understand. And often it's about trying to pick apart what is I can objectively know and what I can only know through the fact that I only have my own experience to draw on. So they're always... a conflict, but I generally try and find a moment where something's been at risk for me, or something where that more difficult thing, like friendship or what you learn from your father, or I root that in something quite close. And that means there's also something at stake for me, something to... I think I'm actually just trying to work something out. And it's normally a timing thing as well. I mean, the friendship film for the Schultz Peanut Show started it 4 years ago, and it was around when my band, the Grubby Mitts, were breaking up in their first incarnation. And they were all school friends that I'd been playing with for sort of 10, 15 years. And so I started to think, so it just forced me to think about how much of our friendship was because we'd been doing these things together, and how much of it was we were doing these things because we were friends. Like, but then I couldn't make it. I was kind of too close to it, or the timing wasn't quite right to be able to explore that. So I had to sort of shelve it for 4 years. And then something else triggered me thinking about it again, but then I could call on that material as a way to work through it. So I was sort of far enough from those tapes to be able to, think about it. So there's often a moving back and forth in time as well for me. It's like often we take something, a certain amount of time will pass with something that has affected me on a... it's not often like some huge life-changing thing or something, but actually nothing very fascinating in its own right necessarily, but just things that are moments that you can tell where your interpretation's been of the world's been affected, or something, or you've like it's forced you to think about something in a way that you hadn't before, or you're and then you sort of drop back into that moment and rework it through from the inside out, and that requires sometimes it's some research into then with the friendship film. It's all the started reading the philosophy of friendship from Cicero to Aristotle, Derrida, trying to make sense, but then also going through loads of old Hollywood films I'd watched as a teenager and trying to find all the scenes, the key scenes where friendship had been the main motif. So it's often having to look in a few places at once. With Laws of Motion, it was, opening the box on rewatching all the golden ages of a cartoon, because so much of my visual imagination had been made there. So it was to go through them but then also to simultaneously read books on physics and books on logic and try and see... I don't know, then at that moment you lose the personal behind and you go off into and hunt and search amongst any fragments of clues that other people have left that will help you, you know, understand your own interpretation.
Mm. That sounds like a really a sort of onerous job, going through a load of old cartoons.
That was awful.
Absolutely,
yeah.
A nightmare. So look, you know, beyond, you mentioned the grubby mitts, and I think since we last met, you've also opened a kind of gallery event space, Ex Baldessari.
Yeah.
First of all, maybe, is it a reference to John Baldessari?
No, only by fortuitous serendipity. No, it's an old upholstery workshop in Bedford, and the proprietor who'd lived there for the previous 50 years was Baldessari, and they had a big sign on the front saying Baldessari's, so I just added an X. But it was nice, because there was a nice bit of confusion at the opening of the show. But I mean, the audience is half people from Bedford, and mostly that's a music community, not so much an arts community, I think. And then people coming out from London for it, for the art element. And then people, in the opening, my mum was serving the drinks, and then my teacher at Royal College and the head of Royal College came down and he was like, talking away about there being a reference to Baldessari. And I was like, looking Tony Blanchard, like, no, Tony Baldessari, like the upholsterer. But I was like, great, locally that means one thing, and then in London it seems to mean something else. And that's also sort of, that seemed quite perfect, that potential confusion.
That kind of, that locally in London thing is something that I wanted to just touch on briefly, because you're notable in that you have for years been based in Bedford. You've kind of chosen not to make art in the city. And I wanted to talk about why that was, whether it's kind of largely financial, whether it's a space concern, or if it's related to your relationship with the town. You just said that there's more of a music community than an arts community. So I was kind of curious as to whether there's something beyond, you know, the economies of it keeping you there.
Passionately ambivalent about Bedford. I haven't really, I think I spent my whole teenage life trying to escape it. And I did so briefly did I get away, and then was somehow, like, I got a thread of my jumper caught in the door as I left or something. And I don't know, I like had to go back, and then before. And then there was a while that you're somewhere and you're thinking, I'm here because I'm on my way somewhere else. You know, I'm in a holding pen where I can get myself together or like prove that I could do this. And then before long, you can't live anywhere under that mentality. Eventually, you just be like, no, you have to admit that you're here because you want to be here, or you don't want to be anywhere else. You just know. But I don't know. And then I try and put things on in the town, and it's just resolutely never worked for 20 years. When we play, it's notable. If the Grubby Mitts play in Bedford, we'll get about, we're lucky if we can get 20. We've done, and it's only once a year. But then we'll leave. That'll be our warm-up show, and we'll go and play somewhere else and be able to get to Vienna to play and had a pretty decent audience. And so I don't know, it's strange, but space and time are such big factors in my work, right? I mean, as you said, these works are laborious. Laws of Motion took, well, from start to finish, that was 5 years, and it's still going in a way. Natural Selection, 6. From initial kind of concept to finishing, even the current film about friendship, 1 year of editing, but then there was a year where I toured the things for it before. So very long-term projects and spatially awkward things. So Bedford is good for, it has time and space in, you know, different quantities and volumes that London has. And particularly early on, when I had a lot of craft processes as well, like the early work, the pyramid piece was all, you know, it was all knitted, and that took a year of, needed to be able to concentrate. And and then it was funny because I sort of was in Bedford, but I wasn't, never quite, still don't feel, I mean, at some point you have to admit you belong somewhere. When you've been there that long, you're like, okay, but it still don't quite feel like it. But then that's probably just the artist's prerogative, to just sort of always be slightly awkwardly at odds with wherever you are. And it doesn't, you know, I don't fit in. Queen's Park, Bedford is, I definitely count as a novelty, having an artist in that part of the, having this, and opening up the little studio now is a fun kind of perverse way of making myself, there's a giant bower in the front garden for a start. I mean, there's no other willow bower sculptures in Queen's Park, Bedford.
Andy Holden there, speaking to Monocle's Augustin Macellari. And Laws of Motion in a Cartoon Landscape is showing at London Cinema Museum from the 21st of February until the 10th of March. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
It couldn't happen here is the all-too-complacent refrain often heard in democracies that might be about to take a troubling turn. And that transformation is explored in the new book, How to Lose a Country, The 7 Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship, from Turkish author and journalist Ece Temokran.
She sat down with Tom earlier to discuss it, and he began by asking what was the main factor that led to the creation of the book.
Well, actually, out of boredom. No, seriously, I was so bored of this excess of emotions, because as you are experiencing in this country because of Brexit, in Turkey, people, and including me, we have been exhausted by excess of emotions due to the political turmoil. At some point, one starts thinking there must be a main mechanism, there must be a main logic to what's happening around us. And what is most needed, I thought, right now for entire world is clarity. People are exhausted of being confused. And I think people are exhausted of politics being reduced to some sort of miserable dichotomies like Brexiteers or anti-Brexiteers and so on. So actually, the book gathers the experience from Turkey, but then it projects this experience to European countries and United States. And I try to give the main logic, the fundamental mechanism of right-wing populism, how it works, how it thinks, how it speaks, how it behaves, so everybody can save the time and energy, because we didn't have the chance in Turkey to do that. We were one of the first experiments, so to speak. And now it's creeping to other countries. They are in the very beginning of the process, but they have to know what's coming towards them. That's why I wrote the book. And also, I now know that rising right-wing populism cannot be beaten only in one country. It really requires a global discussion and global solidarity. And I wanted to bring people into this discussion, conversation, and hopefully solidarity. That's why I wrote the book.
And it's interesting what you said there. There was always this feeling that this was a sort of an insidious, a creeping development yeah. politically. It seems more and more brazen now. It's not that it creeps into their countries. They almost seem to be inviting it in. Can the book, or should the book, serve as a sort of a primer of resistance? Or is it about how to prepare for this happening? I don't know. Is there a distinction to make there, really?
Yeah. Mostly invites people to take a step back. Because even though they are exhausted in Britain, they're exhausted by Brexit. In France, they are shocked by yellow vests. And in several other countries, it's similar things. So before they know it, they find themselves in this dichotomy, in this polarization. So actually, How to Lose a Country invites them to take a step back and warns them about the exhaustion that they might experience if they fall into this dichotomy, if they fall into this turmoil. So is it a call for resistance? Well, why not?
Well, we don't probably have enough, do we?
Yeah.
Or do we? I don't know.
Well, I'm like, people think like to think that, this is good. People are politically engaged. There is more political discussion. People are energized and so on. But I don't think that that's politics. It is running on two choices only. Either you're one of them or you're against them. And this is not politics. And I think we have to resist against this idea more than anything else. So this book is a resistance to be reduced into Brexiteers or non-Brexiteers, or, you know, against the yellow vests or for yellow vests, or, you know, against Alternative für Deutschland populist party in Germany, or being against that. So, you know, the book is resistance against the disruption of rationale, which is one of the common patterns of rising right-wing populism on global level.
Now, I've heard you, it was interesting, that reminds me of a thing I've seen you say before about politics and your frustration with people who say, oh, understandably perhaps, oh, I hate politics, I've had enough.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You say, this is the most, it's not binary, it's not that you hate it or you like it, and to hate politics is the most politically charged comment that you can possibly make. Is there a public misperception about what their own animosity towards the political class is? And actually, they don't hate politics, they don't hate the whole notion of it, they just hate the current practitioners. And maybe we need to all be, and I guess the book talks a bit about this, we need to be a bit more demanding of our political personnel as well.
Yeah. One of the funny things about those people who say, oh, I hate politics, is that they are not aware that this is not their individual idea, individual choice. Actually, this is an argument, this is a motto, let's say. This is a motto that has been imposed on us starting from late 1970s. So people were made to forget that they were political subjects. Therefore, they became political objects, in fact. So as neoliberalism is considered to be a non-ideology, as if, I hate politics is considered to be a non-political motto, where actually it is completely the opposite. One of the things that How to Lose a Country tries to tell people that, okay, that's not politics. To start with, you know, watching politicians fighting each other is not following politics. And politics is much richer and much sexier than that. And one of the things, one of the subtitles of this issue, so to speak, is about women. There is this misconception about political books and women. The entire publishing industry thinks that women do not read political books. Whereas I do think that more than ever, women are more interested in politics because they are like the coal mine canaries, so to speak. They are feeling the close of political malady before anyone else. So they are more and more interested in politics. So I think it is the women who should be saying no whenever someone says, oh, I hate politics. No, you love politics, in fact. When you really do that, when you really do politics, when you really speak politics, you'll know that you'll like it.
Actually, let me ask you a little bit about, to pick up on that point about going back to the 70s and looking for the root causes of this. And I know there's this notion that, you know, we had, I guess, a lot of the political process cast in this idea of that there were winners and losers. And you've talked before about how during that period that was thrown into very sharp focus. Are those processes cyclical? Can we reassure ourselves that if we read How to Lose a Country, what is lost once is not lost forever? Is there some reassurance that these things are cyclical, or do we not get that if we if we read the book?
Well, it's the book. I'd like to think that the book is remedy for all diseases, for all political and moral diseases, of course. But at least one can be sure that it's a genuinely written book. And what I mean by that is, there are many books about populism right now. It has almost become an intellectual industry at the moment. But I do think that many of them, unfortunately, are speaking to each other, not to the people. So I'd like to think that How to Lose a Country echoes beyond the echo chambers of intellectual circles and opinion makers. One interesting observation in between the interviews, in between the book events that I have been doing and I will be doing this week, I came to notice that when I speak to people who are not in the book business, who are not writing or something, you know, makeup people, taxi drivers, they are more interested in the book because they need clarity more than ever right now because they don't know actually what's going on. I mean, like, there are TV journalists who say that I don't have the foggiest idea, so we cannot expect them to understand. So, yeah, the book is written for people whose job is not to write or read books, in fact.
Well, to that point then, I wonder if you talk to artists, for example, and they'll say, well, I'm always mindful of the perception of my work depending on the space in which it's shown, whether it's a museum here or a gallery or a private space or it's in the public domain. Do you look at your own writings that way? And do you consider that reader that you're trying to talk to, whether they're in Ankara or maybe they're in Moscow or in London or in Washington, D.C. or in Caracas, does that broader context, I mean, naturally it informs their perspective. Do you ever think about that when you're, especially writing a book of this character?
Well, to start with, I wrote the book in English, and this is the first book I wrote in English. This was the reason I wanted to speak to that guy in China and that woman in Russia and that kid in United States who is concerned about climate change. One good thing about our times is social media. Although we like to despise it, we like to make condescending, sarcastic, you know, remarks about social media, it's an amazing, magical thing because it really cannot filter the genuineness of the word, if they are so. And it really brings the best and the worst out of you. So I think through social media, How to Lose a Country will be more seen and people will talk to each other. The book has, I think the book has something in it that anyone who reads it feels like challenging the book, challenging the ideas in the book, which feels so good to me right now because not every book does that.
Well, and do you think that's because we've all become a bit passive? And I wonder whether even on as you say, things like social media that often antagonize people, we're now used to saying, oh, well, yes, this is just white noise. This isn't about me. And we're becoming immunized to dissent because we just say, well, we know certain people say, oh, this is not real or it's fake news or whatever.
Haters will hate.
Well, this is it, in essence. I don't know. How do you achieve that then? How do you make sure that it's resonant enough that people will stick with you and be engaged by it, but you're still confident enough to land some telling blows? How can you... Is that a balance you try and strike when you're writing?
No, I think it happens naturally. I saw it during Gezi uprising in Turkey and in Tahrir in Cairo. All these news networks, you know, the biggest ones, who invested millions of dollars on their logos to be trusted by the audiences, weren't chosen by the social media followers, whereas all these social media followers were trying to find the guy there speaking from the street and telling the truth. Sort of. So it was as if humans were choosing humans over institutions, over the establishment, sort of. So I think social media does that connection, creates that connection somehow naturally. Although we shouldn't be forgetting the fact that these are companies, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you about. Because even go back to, like, if you look at the Arab Spring, and this was the new narrative, it was about total seizing of control from the established means of communication and all the rest. We seem to be in a difficult moment now where, and I know you yourself made some remarks about some of the key figures behind some of the big social media players, the Silicon Valley types, who you're maybe, how can we say, skeptical about their
of course I am. Like, you know.
So, but how do we strike that balance? Because it feels like now the social media playing field is as fraught with as many or more challenges than the big established media companies. Where is that true voice? Because, I mean, I am reluctant to trust social media platforms because I don't know where it's coming from. Is it, where do I find that human connection if not in an actual face-to-face?
That is true. I'm like, for some reason we started speaking about social media companies as if they are public institutions who are there for the good of humanity, whereas
or
they
regulated
are
or whatever it might
you know,
be, yeah.
profit-oriented entities. So never forget that. We should never forget that. That's true. But on the other hand, I think we should remember that during the times of political resistance, these tools were used by the people according to their own goals, and they were used beautifully, so to speak. It depends how much political courage and how much political power you have. You can manipulate the entire machine if you have the political power to do that. So sometimes we do have that power. Sometimes we don't. And I think these are the times we don't have that power. But in 2013, when Tahrir was happening, I think that was a different time and social media was used differently. In How to Lose a Country, there is one section, the defeatist emotions on social media. When there is that energy, resistant energy, social media becomes a hub of joy. And you feel the true joy of friendship and becoming one and, you know, true joy of being a human being. But when there is political defeat, right now it is some way it's like that, when there's political defeat, that energy becomes self-destructive and people start beating each other, so to speak, all that joy, when all that joy disappears. So it depends on the political power, how much political power the resistance has.
I wonder whether there's a requirement on, if we certainly look at Western liberal democracies, for people to be a little more grateful for what they have. Because I know you've often written before about how important it is to remember and how memory frames a lot of these questions. And a lot of people say of Trump and of, well, look at Britain now pitching to sort of divorce itself from Europe. But just think back, it's only a couple of generations. My parents' generation, people remember what happened in the Second World War. Do we need to say, look, it's imperfect, it's flawed, often deeply so, but it's a lot better than the alternatives, and your book traces how easily we can get something that's far, far worse, far more damaging to people's freedoms and far more damaging to democracy. It's not defeatist, is it, to say this may be imperfect, but it's a lot better than the alternatives?
I think you cannot make politics over the word gratefulness. And you cannot say, people, let's keep it this way, otherwise we're going to be doomed, you know, damned or something. But one of the things right-wing populism has in common in all of the countries is the contribution of cynical leftists. which is something like when Trump is speaking about the hypocrisy of establishment, you go and say, well, it's not wrong, actually. The establishment is full of hypocrisy. Yes, that is true. Or if they say anything about, you know, Erdogan was talking about a judiciary system, the, you know, courts and so on, there is no justice there. Well, I could say the same thing. The main difference is we are not hating establishment or unjust system for the same reasons. So we shouldn't be contributing to this relentless destructive energy, destructive politics. We have to make distinctions, and this is quite a sensitive issue. Whereas I do not believe that, okay, we have to keep the walls together, keep the establishment together. I don't believe in that. But in the book, I tell it quite in detail. But when the institutions start collapsing because of the right-wing populism's terrorizing effect, one understands very soon that you have to especially defend the judiciary system. Otherwise, all is gone.
It's Demelker, and they're speaking to Tom Edwards. And How to Lose a Country is out now. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly.
And that's all we have time for on today's edition of The Weekly. Marcus, what a programme. A little light, a little shade. Lots of great learnings. I feel like we had one eye or half an eye on the future, which is always a good place to be on a Sunday lunchtime.
Anyway, that is all for this edition, edition 502 of The Monocle Weekly.
That's a big number, isn't it? Let's thank the people behind the glass. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Marcus Hippe, it's goodbye.